it's funny. Normally, as we think about medical literature, we think about getting our information from the journals. Yeah, you know, we think about New England Journal publishing data. We think about JAMA, like all these journals would be publishing data. And nowadays, as everything is shifting so quickly and we're getting so much information every day, including with social media and whatnot, the ways that we get information is also changing as well. I mean, I can tell you right now, a lot of the information I'm getting is from being on a text string with people I trained with. So people in Colorado, in New York, in Boston, San Diego, Seattle. These are where, you know, friends of mine from residency and fellowship are. And now we're on a text string and email string and on Facebook. And we're talking about our problems. Like, hey, what kind of patients are you seeing?
And now, from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast, with your host, Christine Winoto.
Our guest today is Dr. Adi Darya, a UCSF-trained pulmonary and critical care doctor. He's also the principal of our fund, MedTech Venture Partners. Adi and his wife both are doctors, and both of them are on the front lines of the fight against COVID-19. And today, Adi will tell us about the impact this global pandemic is having on healthcare providers like them, and how they are raising to prepare in California for what they can see is happening in Boston and New York and Italy, and what may be only a week or two ahead for us here. You'll also learn the impact of COVID-19 to care provider and their family. Adi and his wife have to revisit their living will and also have a family conversation about how to proceed in case one of them have the virus. He also shared with us on how medical staff are planning and allocating resources and how those plans are changing daily. Adi talks about short, medium, and long-term solutions, many of which come down to the same issue: how to provide oxygen to the COVID-19 patients who are most severely affected. While this crisis is incredibly stressful for us all, it is reassuring to know that highly trained, calm, clear-thinking medical staff and doctors such as Adi are in charge, doing their very best to steer us through this difficult period until the world can get this COVID-19 under control. And on behalf of the UCSF Rosenman Institute, I would like to thank all our healthcare providers who are on the front line of this pandemic. Stay safe and healthy. I hope you enjoy our conversation. And if you like what you hear today, please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. And one more thing, are you a founder of a health technology startup looking for an industry partner or seeking funding from seed to Series A? Apply to the 2020 Rosenman Innovators by Tuesday, April 14. Applications are open on February 18 and details on our website at rosemaninstitute.org. Welcome, Adi. Thanks for joining me this morning. I know it's a really busy time for you with what's going on right now in our country, in our cities. I thought it would be good I know there's a lot of information out there about COVID-19, but I thought it would be good to start a conversation a little bit about what is COVID-19, why it's dangerous, why shelter in place can help to slow down the pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely. So COVID-19, we'll start kind of very, very at the basics, just very, very quickly. So COVID-19 is a virus. It's a part of a family of viruses called coronaviruses. And this particular species of virus is very pathogenic. And that's what's setting it apart from a lot of the previous coronaviruses that we're familiar with, where the prior viruses in the corona family, normally we think about just causing a common cold. And you get over it after, you know, a few days to a week, and you go on your life. But this coronavirus is definitely much different. What we're seeing is that people are getting much sicker. They're ending up in the hospital. They're ending up in the ICU with a whole host of complications. You know, there's some portion of the population who are relatively asymptomatic. I'd say that's some percentage. We actually don't know the numbers of that yet because our testing isn't quite up to speed. there's another portion of the population that's having what we call mild symptoms or mild to moderate symptoms. And even in this patient population, we're seeing that their symptoms are more significant than we normally would associate with a coronavirus, where they're feeling quite ill for at least 7 to 10 days with fatigue, fevers that are ongoing for over a week, chills, cough. When it gets severe enough, we're also seeing that people are developing a pneumonia, and a pretty significant pneumonia at that, that's causing low oxygen levels in their blood. These are also the people that we're seeing in the hospital. And they come in, they have these low oxygen levels, and they need oxygen support in the hospital. When it gets severe enough, they develop something called ARDS, which is acute respiratory distress syndrome. And this is a situation where both a combination of the virus as well as the immune system affects the lungs, so the lungs can't work as intended. So you can't get oxygen into the blood, you can't get carbon dioxide out of the blood, and it leaves people very sick. Historically, severe forms of ARDS have a mortality rate of upwards of 40%. So already a severe disease, and we're seeing a lot of these patients who are coming in from the community getting severe ARDS, which is a major concern because they need an incredible amount of support in the ICU. You know, we're seeing a lot of older people, and certainly the mortality rate in older people is higher. But I think something that we're also seeing now, at least in the hospitals that I'm seeing, we're seeing a good number of young people. And I'm talking about people who are, you know, over the age of 30, 40, coming in, and they're ending up in the ICU on the ventilator. So that was a little bit of a surprise, especially with the data coming out of China, that we're seeing a lot of these surprisingly younger people.
Why do you think there's a lot more young people that you see?
So that's a great question. I don't know if I have a great answer for you in terms of why there's more young people. You know, some of the observations that we've been having are that some of the younger people do have additional health problems, including obesity, as we're seeing in a lot of the hospitals, that young obese people seem to be getting affected quite significantly. And I say that with some context in the sense that in 2009, with the H1N1 epidemic, the flu epidemic then, one of the patient populations that was getting severely affected then were actually obese people, so BMIs greater than 30, and young. And that was a major concern. We also saw some pregnant ladies and so forth who were being affected more so than the general population. That's not something we're seeing here in terms of pregnant people here. But the obese young people is a concern. We're still waiting on a lot of this data to come out. So what I'm speaking of is very anecdotal. So we'll see as we continue to get the numbers and we're able to publish the data, we'll get a much better sense of who this is affecting, how severely they're affecting them. And as we get our testing up higher, we'll have a better sense of both the incidence and the prevalence rates of the disease. These are all very much, everything is changing so quickly. You know, it's funny, normally as we think about medical literature, we think about getting our information from the journals. Yeah, you know, we think about New England Journal publishing data. We think about JAMA, like all these journals would be publishing data. And nowadays, as everything is shifting so quickly, and we're getting so much information every day, including with social media and whatnot, the ways that we get information is also changing as well. I mean, I can tell you right now, a lot of the information I'm getting is from being on a text string with people I trained with. So people in Colorado, in New York, in Boston, San Diego, Seattle. These are where, you know, friends of mine from residency and fellowship are, and now we're on a text string and email string and on Facebook, and we're talking about our problems. Like, hey, what do you do? What kind of patients are you seeing? Are you seeing people with liver disease? Are you seeing people with kidney disease? What's going on with their heart? Or, you know, so we have all these interactions that are going on essentially real time, which is very different than historically when we didn't have these tools available. So it's very interesting. I mean, for me to see all this, it's incredibly interesting. It's actually been really useful to have other people to bounce ideas off of, you know, as we go along in real time as well.
And then these are the people that you trust in a way, rather than just an open forum.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely people you trust. And you know, it's different specialties too. I mean, we have there's a group of hospitalists who are commenting. We have cardiologists, we have pulmonary critical care docs, all in the same group. So GI docs who are all kind of contributing, saying different things about what they're seeing. You know, the East Coast right now, Boston and New York are getting hit quite hard. We're a little bit behind that curve. So we're leaning a lot of what they're saying, how their experience is going, things that we need to prepare for right now. We're listening to them and trying our best to prepare our staffing, equipment, you know, getting everyone prepared for what we anticipate being the surge here in California, literally over the next two to three weeks, I think, is when I would expect this surge to happen.
What are the things that you prepare based on what you learned from your colleague who's going through it right now?
Yeah, so some of the things that we're preparing for, one is just about staffing. So how many people can we actually take care of when the hospital gets full and extends itself completely? Who should be doing what roles? The hospitalist, the intensivist, you have kind of overlapping roles. And sometimes you have to split those roles up a little bit. The emergency room clearly needs to be prepared. You have to have physical space for these patients. Respiratory techs need to be, you know, upped because it's going to be a huge need. The nurses need to be prepared as well, both from a staffing perspective as well as everyone needs to be prepared in terms of how to take care of ourselves and PPE. I mean, PPE is in the news every night nowadays in terms of, you know, the lack of PPE. Right. So we're talking about this a lot. We're trying to get ready for it. What's appropriate PPE for what situation of patients, trying to get everyone on the same page. It's a huge task. And the fact that it changes every 48 hours makes it even harder because, you know, you look at the CDC and the WHO recommendations and they're changing, we're changing, everything is changing kind of as we speak. So it's been challenging. I mean, I can tell you when I've been in the ICU, you know, we've had patients come in and we don't know what type of PPE to wear for that particular patient. You know, if they're on high flow nasal cannula, which is a type of oxygen delivery, or a certain type of mask, we say, oh, we need to wear more extensive protection, or no, we don't need to wear it. You know, it's a discussion that we have in the hospital, you know, in the middle of the night when we don't exactly know the right guidance. So certainly something we're seeing a lot of.
Do you think it's because of some shortages in the PPE that requires you to have that discussion? Or is it something that would have been normal even if you have enough PPE?
Yes, I think absolutely. And part of it is we don't know what's going to happen in a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks. So we don't want to use up all our PPE right now and then not have any when there's even more patients. So it's a moving target that is impossible to know ahead of time. And, you know, in 2 or 3 months, we'll be like, oh, we should have done this differently. We should have done this differently. But it's impossible to really know that right now. So we're doing our best. You know, you have to look at the numbers. You try to use the modeling to try to predict how many patients are going to be coming in, how many masks you're going to end up using. Are there going to be additional resources that come online down the road that you can use? You need to figure out ways to sterilize PPE over and over again so you use the same mask, you know, for multiple days, for multiple patients. So these are things that we're actively trying to figure out. I mean, at some point you have to do something and actually make a decision. And we're getting close to that point now. I would say that all the hospitals that I work in, both in the Sutter system and the Kaiser system, we've had enough PPE so far. I haven't felt that we haven't been protected or in terms of what I've seen. I know people in New York and Boston, Chicago have a different story where they're down low and, you know, they've been told to reduce their usage and use the same one over again. That's a huge concern. Absolutely.
Yeah. That sounds really scary. I mean, both you and your wife are doctors and treating patients with COVID-19. How are you guys as a family coping with this?
Yeah. So it has been challenging. for lots of reasons. As you mentioned, my wife is a hospitalist, so she's frontline as well. I'm in the ICU, and we've had now multiple discussions, like fairly difficult, hard to stomach discussions about different scenarios that would happen if one of us were to get sick. What would we do with the kids? What would we do with the other person? Do we leave the house? How would that work logistically? Who would watch the sick person? Do we all stay in the same house? Should we go, move people to family? Knowing that we're at such a high risk, our family, our household is at such a high risk, we've actually have sent everyone away from our house. We had, support from our parents. We've sent them all away with the fear that they would get sick from us. So it's been very challenging. We have three small kids, so right. So it's been challenging to keep them busy. We don't know. We're still in discussions about bringing people in to help with the kids during the day, so one of us could get a break and do other work. So that's like an ongoing discussion where we don't want to expose somebody from the community either. To our high risk house. We've had discussions about our will. We've reorganized our will, which is generally not something you want to do, but something that we decided was important at this point. We had to, make sure everything was in the trust, all the things that, you don't want to talk about. We've kind of been talking about those. At the same time, it's wonderful having her in the house. She's somebody we can, we both have these discussions every day now about what's been going on with us, what's going on in our hospital, what are some of the challenges that we're facing. When she has to do a lot of the planning for the PPE at her hospital, so she's actively engaged with that, their staffing. So it's actually really useful to have both of us to bounce ideas off of. Mm-hmm. I found it very useful. I find it incredibly informative and educational to learn her experience with these patients and what she's seeing as well. So it's been great from that respect. But we also realize that we want to make sure there's always one healthy parent for the kids.
right.
And that's been a challenge, I'd say. It's been, we're nervous about it for sure.
Yeah, it's hard to hedge your risks when you both are exposed to the patients.
Yeah. Agreed.
And as regular people here can help you feel the ease of this, challenges that you face. I always tell people that shelter in place is not really just for you, but it's for other people. And how is that helpful, do you think?
So yeah, shelter in place is I think our main tool at this point for trying to control the number of infections and the number of deaths over the next few months to potentially even longer. As you say, it's not about just you because if you do get the virus or you do spread it, it's about who you spread it to and how many other people are affected by what you do. Right now, as we look at the number of people coming into the hospital, I was looking at some of the numbers just this morning, and the number of ICU beds doubled in this area. So the number of people in the ICU doubled overnight, and that's a crazy, crazy statistic. And usually it goes up, but not that much. So we're just kind of like on that verge of going into where New York is, where Italy potentially has been if it gets really extreme. So if we're able to flatten that curve, and this is a phrase that I think is ubiquitous now, as well as social distancing, if we're able to flatten that curve, that does mean life or death situations for so many people can be avoided. It's incredibly important. I can tell you, our family has just been in our house. We don't interact with anybody. We don't have no friends over. We take it very seriously. As I was saying, not only are we a high risk household, but the idea of social distancing is something that we take incredibly seriously.
I know that can be really hard for some people, but I found technology has been really helpful. I hear people doing a virtual happy hour, virtual dinner with friends. So I really encourage people to do that. And it's been fun, try to keep the best out of the bad situation we are in.
This podcast is sponsored by Ron Ratnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that helps life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownratnick.com.
I also want to go back a little bit, like for patients who end up in ICU, where that's when you see them, what happened to their body? And I know we hear a lot about we need more ventilators and why ventilator is crucial and what the situation right now with ventilators, sharing ventilator, how is that affecting the patient's chance of survival?
So yes, when people come in with what we call hypoxemic respiratory failure, and the word hypoxemic means low oxygen level. So when the oxygen levels get too low in the blood, you have to support them. And normally we use a step up algorithm where when we're breathing room air and we're not able to get enough oxygen, we'll just put on a simple nasal cannula that can deliver low amounts of oxygen. And we continue to step up that algorithm until we get to the most invasive and maximum amount of support, which is being put on a breathing machine or a ventilator. And a ventilator offers a couple main advantages. One of them is that you can deliver 100% oxygen into the lungs. And not all of that oxygen gets into the blood, but enough of it gets into the blood that you can keep up the level of oxygen in your blood. In addition to the amount of oxygen you can deliver higher pressures than normal. And this is particularly relevant for the COVID patients coming in with pneumonia and ARDS, is that we are seeing that they're actually very responsive to the pressure. And the pressure does a couple different things. One is it keeps your lung open. So lung has a tendency of collapsing when it gets fluid in it. And if you're able to keep that lung open, it can participate in gas exchange, which is very important. In addition to that, it kind of pushes out some of the fluid. It may help from a hemodynamics perspective as well, depending on what's going on with your heart. So we think that this high pressure that the ventilator can deliver can protect the lungs in a sense, and that's exactly what we want to do. And I should say the third thing that the ventilator can do is that it can deliver a very certain amount of breath. It delivers a certain amount of volume every time, and that's important in the sense that when you want to protect the lungs, you don't want your lungs over distended. If you are over distending your lungs, you're almost certainly injuring your lungs. So what we do when these patients come into the ICU, we actually decrease the amount of tidal volume that we're giving. And tidal volume is how big is a breath. So the breaths are very small, usually very rapid breaths. And that the whole idea is that we can protect the lungs in that sense. We still are able to deliver the oxygen because we can crank it up to 100% and we can put it on high pressure. So we get the oxygen in the blood and we protect the lungs. That's the optimal situation that a ventilator can deliver. When there's not enough support, then there's even more advanced measures, but those are much more burdensome on the health system. You can try to turn people over. It's called proning, so their face is down, and that helps with getting oxygen in the blood. And then the most extreme is getting put on a heart-lung bypass machine, which we call ECMO. And I know there's a couple people who've been on ECMO in the Bay Area over the last few weeks for COVID. I'm sure we'll see some data coming out about treating COVID patients with ECMO. I don't know what the data is at this moment. I would say for young people with minimal complications, it's certainly an option as well. There's lots of bad things associated with ECMO as well. So nothing we do, everything we do has side effects, I should say.
And what is the side effect for being put in ECMO?
So ECMO, the main side effects are that you can get the oxygen, you can get blood to the body, but you have to be on fairly high levels of anticoagulation. So there's definitely a risk for bleeding. You need to have a fairly large cannula placed where either into your neck or your groin, because you have to get very high volumes of blood out to run through the machine. And we're talking anywhere from 2 to 5 liters of blood per minute. So huge, you know, it's a lot. That's your whole cardiac output. That's all the blood that's going through your body has to go through the machine to get oxygenated. And in addition to that, you know, we only have a small number of ECMO machines at any given hospital. It requires a high level of expertise to place the cannulas, to manage the ECMO. And from a nursing perspective, normally you need 2 ICU nurses for every ECMO patient with additional support. So it's incredibly resource intensive. If we're looking at the number of patients that we project for COVID, there would not be the possibility of ECMO would be very restricted to very particular situations. We certainly cannot offer ECMO to everyone. And actually, getting to your point, can we even offer ventilators to everyone? And this is a major question in our mind, and the models vary depending on what numbers you put in based on the assumptions that you make. And the idea right now is we want to flatten the curve to the point where we have enough ventilators for everyone who's sick at any given time. If we see a very large surge, we may not have enough ventilators. And what do we do then? And people have taken different approaches to this. So you'll see anytime you have a limited resource and it's a life-saving resource, you know, the question of medical ethics definitely comes into play. Who should we treat? Who should we not treat? And if we can't treat everybody, you know, we have to prioritize somebody. This is an ongoing debate in the medical community about who we should treat or who we shouldn't treat. I will say that each of the hospitals now is actively discussing this, and they have a protocol in place that involves every hospital has an ethics board that involves the ethics board, usually a triage team that's separate from the treating doctor that will help make the determination of who may get treated and who wouldn't get treated. Oftentimes it's based on severity of illness and other organs that are affected. So if you're coming in and your heart and your lungs and your liver, kidneys are all down, that generally portends a worse outcome. And age is clearly a part of this as well. So those people may not get treated, as opposed to somebody who only has their lungs down as their only organ system down. We can be more aggressive with them. The idea being that they're more likely to recover than the sicker patient.
And I know we've seen that. I've not seen it, but I've heard it from in Italy. That's what they've been doing as well because of the limited resources. Have you heard that from your colleague who are in the East Coast in New York or Boston that they have to make that decision yet?
I have not heard that as much. From the New York people, their hospitals luckily they're totally at capacity, or I should say like 150% capacity, but they have not had to make those decisions yet. I'm sure there are doctors who have had to make those decisions. In Boston, they have not had to make those decisions yet either. I think we're getting to that point. I haven't spoken to some people for a few days, so based on the doubling time, they may be there already. I know in New York, the governor said it was okay to try to treat multiple people with the same ventilator. So this actually brings up the idea of what we can do to potentially help that ventilator situation. And the way that I think about it is honestly, there's probably some shorter-term solutions, like shorter-term solution, mid-term solution, and longer-term solutions. And the longer term solutions are easy because we can make more ventilators, and you know, different people can make the ventilators. If it's auto industry, if it's the ventilator people, that's the best solution. But it's going to take time, quite a long time, I think. In the shorter term, the question is, what can we do to help support these people? And there's been a lot of discussions, and I know there's a few teams that I'm aware of, at least a few teams, I should say, that I'm aware of that are trying to tackle this problem. One of the ways that people are looking at it is to take one ventilator and split it to multiple patients, potentially 2 to even 4 patients with one ventilator. This has been tried and explored in the past, generally associated with emergency-based like preparedness discussions. And there was a team that tried it in the mid-2000s on the bench, and then they tried it in animals as well. And they were able to do it with some success. There's a lot of reservations and a lot of problems with it.
What are the reservations and the problem?
So the main problems are, if you're treating multiple people, they're all connected. So you worry about contamination. You're worried about how one person might affect the other person. You're worried that you're not treating anyone perfectly. So you might decrease everyone's chances of survival rather than focusing on one person. And knowing that what we know about this type of lung disease, if you treat people poorly, we know that their risk of mortality does go up significantly. And for these reasons, actually, this is why most of the major societies have actually come out against using multiple ventilators or multiple patients on a single ventilator until we have additional tools. So I've been working with a team from Berkeley. There's a team out of UCSD that I'm well aware of that they're trying to help add in a little additional features to a ventilator to make it safer for multiple patients. For example, if you could put in a valve before every patient that can help determine how much pressure or volume that particular person is seeing, that would be incredibly helpful. You have to have one-way valves between each of the patients. So on exhalation, one person's breath, exhaled breath, doesn't go into the other person's lungs. That would be bad as well. You need filters between all of these patients. So these are all like the small things that need to be done in order to make a vent safe for multiple people. And then clearly it has to be, once all this system and the device additions are done, it has to be tested and verified that you can do what you say you do. So there's a decent amount of work that needs to be done to do it, but people are definitely looking at that very closely on how to do it. And the other main way that people are looking to help with a ventilator shortage is looking at other types of devices that can also provide a similar type of support. So a lot of people have obstructive sleep apnea or OSA, and they have these machines at home called CPAPs or BiPAPs that deliver a pressure into your mouth to keep your airway open. But the thought is that can we use those same devices to deliver oxygen and pressure to these patients? And they're, you know, not being able to dictate how much volume is going in is a major problem. But if you have the situation of trying this or having somebody die, it seems to make sense that you try something if you're able to get it at least safe enough to treat on people or to use on people. Mm-hmm. So there's multiple teams also looking at this. What are the small modifications that we can make for these devices to enable them to get to patients? And we have to do this in an incredibly rapid way. I mean, you know, if we're behind the eight ball already. So if we have 2 weeks left before our surge starts, let's say, or 1 week, we have to get all the stuff mm-hmm. done. We have to have all the connections. All these things need to be done and in place and manufactured before they would even be possible. And, you know, there's a whole regulatory aspect that needs to be worked through as well. So working with it, right. with the FDA. So all these teams are doing it as best they can. And there's no solution, I'd say. At this point in time, there's no solution. Hopefully in a week or 2 weeks, we're able to have those very short-term solutions. And then we can, you know, continue to modify these devices to make them safer and safer to have some medium-term solutions before the new ventilators come online in the longer mm-hmm. term.
So how realistic do you think to expect to have some solution within the next 2 weeks for you guys?
I think it's a little bit, I think in the next week it'd be far-fetched. I'm always amazed at what people can do and their level of innovation. So I would hope that in the next 2 weeks we can have something online. You need a whole infrastructure. For example, with the CPAP and BiPAP machines, you have to have some way to collect the machines. You have to have a way to modify the machines, test the machines, and then get them deployed. That full infrastructure would need to be in place realistically. Before we can get these to patients. To get that done in a couple of weeks would need a significant amount of resources. I know these teams are looking for resources on both the state and federal levels. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're trying to get the resources to be able to even try this. And I would encourage, you know, this type of innovation is exactly what we need right now. Mm-hmm. It would have been great to have done it 4 weeks ago or 6 weeks ago, or 8 weeks ago, whatever it is, but We didn't know about it. We didn't have it done. So now we're in a situation where we have to get it done in the next couple of weeks. Or, yeah, you know, we're going to be potentially in a situation that Italy was in, where they have to choose who gets treatment, who doesn't get treatment.
I mean, right now, when you look at the numbers for California, it looks better, much better than in New York. Let's hope that it doesn't get as bad as New York.
Yeah.
But again, it's hard to know, I guess, until we have more tests.
Yeah, until we have more tests and the social distancing, the latency period between us making an intervention. So if we started social distancing 2 weeks ago, we probably don't even see that effect for 3 weeks at the minimum, potentially even longer. So so the people who are now sick in the ICU happened before we started social distancing. And that's just the time course of this disease is much longer than we've seen in the past. Mm-hmm. I mean, people, when they come in, they can deteriorate very quickly, but they're on a ventilator for 10 to 14 days before they start to get better. And that is 50%, 60% longer than the average ARDS patient that comes in into the ICU. You know, there's probably about two, last time I looked, there's just over 200,000 cases of ARDS in the United States every year. This year is going to be, multiples of that. We might have 200,000 deaths solely from this disease over this year. So it's like hard to fathom.
You mentioned earlier, patient with ARDS, that their mortality rate is 40% even before with this current pandemic.
Yeah, that's severe ARDS. So ARDS is defined by how bad the oxygen level is. So people who develop severe ARDS, the mortality rate in the clinical studies is a little bit lower, in the 30% range. If you look back at observational data in communities, it's a little bit higher. So it's in the 40% range. But it's a very severe disease. There's no doubt about it. That your lungs, the inability of your lungs to work affects a whole host of different organs. You go into multi-organ dysfunction, and then mortality is very high from there.
So one last thing before we conclude our conversation today, many of our listeners are innovators. What would you say to them right now that can help you treat your patient better and also flatten the curve?
Yeah. So flattening the curve, I think.
We all know it, right?
Yeah, there's social distancing. I mean, I still think there's actually innovation to happen on that end as well. How to prevent viruses from passing from one to another. What's the best way of keeping people clean, their hands in the air. You could think of different innovations for different spaces, at the home and the hospital and so forth. So I think there's definitely innovation to happen there as well. On the other end, testing I think is still remains a big deal. The innovators can think about how we get testing done, how to do it efficiently, using the current technology, how to ramp it up faster. That to me is a huge part of it right now. On the treatment end, I think a lot of the innovation, you can break it up into different types of innovation. Telehealth is becoming necessary, I'd say, not even useful, but necessary. Where me as an ICU doctor, I can sit in front of a computer and take care of many more patients than if I had to go into the rooms, in and out of the rooms, in and out of the rooms. And this telemedicine idea with infectious disease doctors, which are not available in large parts of the country. So that type of innovation definitely needs to be happening and has been happening, honestly, in the telehealth arena. But I think there's still more needs to be done on how to monitor patients both inside the hospital and at home. Other treatment options, how to treat people with oxygen problems. This is something that's been a problem for quite some time. That's not an easy problem to solve. That's not going to be the lowest hanging fruit, honestly. That'll be a bigger fruit that needs, bigger, higher up fruit on the tree, but something that certainly needs solving as well. Are there easier ways to get oxygen into people? Are there easier ways to deliver ECMO, life supporting therapy? These are all questions that I think need additional work, additional minds on them as well. Other innovation that I would like to see. Those are probably the main ones that I can think of. I'm sure there's like a ton more that people can think of.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'd like to thank you for your hard work, and it's not an easy time for you and your family and your wife. Stay safe and thinking a lot about you, and hopefully this thing shall pass as well. So crossing my finger.
It will. I think we're all in it together. I have hope. I think, you know, in a few months, I think things will hopefully look dramatically different than they look now. So, yeah, we just gotta, it's day by day. Like, literally, it's day by day, right? This is how we've been approaching it in our house.
Stay healthy, stay safe, and best of luck. And we need you.
Thank you, Christine.
Thank you, Ajay.
Thank you for listening today, and don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.